Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Bring yourself back online.
No one knows what I'm thinking.
Tell us what you think of your world.
This is just a cheap trick.
Some people choose to see the ugliness in this world. The disarray. I choose to see the beauty.
Welcome to Still Watching Westworld, an unofficial podcast about the HBO series Westworld. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
Each week, we break down the latest theories, baffling questions, and hidden allusions, as well as occasionally chat with someone who has worked on the show itself. This week, we have the star of this episode, Zahn McLaren, who plays Akichita. But before we talk to him, we will be breaking down the episode, Season 2, Episode 8, Kiksuya, directed by Uta Brejcevic and written by Carly Rae. And actually, even before we get into that, we wanted to actually kick off with a listener email. Richard, are you ready for me to go super deep with you?
Please. Yeah, deep into the mailbag.
Deep into the mailbag. All right. So this one comes from Dan. This is a great email. And Dan says, I've been mulling over the same question about the human mind egg copies, Delos/Ford, etc., here in season 2. Seems to me that this wouldn't be immortality. I've been interpreting these as an exact copy of someone's mind, but never does it seem to me as if the person's actual consciousness leaves their human bodies to live in the pearls or whatever they're called. So you die and a copy of you lives on. That's still not you, though, so who cares? Anyway, is this how you see it? It's been tearing me up, I tell ya, says Dan. So, like, this question of digital immortality and what it means, we should say that the name of this episode, Kiksuya, is a Lakota term for the word remember. And this idea of memories and having your memories in your new robot body seems to me a big part of whether or not that is actually you. Like, is that actually Jim Delos, the one that we met in episode 4, I think it was. So, like, what do you think about this idea of what makes a person, Richard, and what allows for some kind of digital immortality?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? Because, like, you know, if a version of you, and it's a sentient version of you, you know, as sentient as this technology can get it, so your version of you is gone, but another one is aware. So, like, are you still alive? Not really, no. But, like, in terms of how the world is concerned, there is a consciousness that looks like you looked like and thought like you thought. And so, yes, you do exist still. So I think it seems more about, like, almost like passing on, you know, the sort of mantle to a child, you know, and continuing on your line that way rather than you yourself staying alive forever.
Something we talked about on this other Westworld podcast that I do was this, I guess it's a well-known thought experiment about this kind of cloning or immortality where, let's say transportation to Mars existed, but what would have to happen is that you step into a transporter and you disappear and then an exact replica of you with all your memories appears on Mars, but you, Richard, are gone. And then a copy of you lives on Mars. Do you do that?
No.
You don't do that. No. See, I said yes.
No.
Because I was sort of like, what's the difference? And you feel like there's a difference.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'm a narcissist
ahead.
I don't know. But
no, I think that's the ineffable sort of thing of what makes you you. Right. Whereas I'm like, I'm being like a weird sociopath about it. I'm like, what's the difference? And you're like, no, this is me. I get to stay.
This you know? Is me, Joanna. Remember what Circus Musical taught us. To proudly stay that this is me.
Yeah, your proudest achievement, the film that you made with Hugh Jackman, the Circus Musical.
Yeah, wrote, directed, produced, catered, everything.
Right. Proudly says, this is me.
I designed Keala Settle's beard. Yeah, I was really all hands on.
So anyway, if anyone listening has other thoughts on sort of what makes... I will say this. I feel like, perversely, the sort of ghosty code version of Ford is a closer approximation of immortality, as I understand it, than the Jim Delos that we met in episode 4.
Yes, I think so. But mostly because of how people perceive him, you know, yeah. Like he's still, you know, whispering his weird poetry and stuff. So he might as well be the same thing.
But so even without the physical body, to me, that is the kind of immortality. And that's exactly sort of what Westworld said in season 1, where it was like, Beethoven, you know, just became the music, right? So right. Mozart just became the music. So Ford just becomes a code. That's an immortality to me. A weird, like, glitching robot that doesn't even know how to pour fucking cream and coffee is not immortality, as far as I'm concerned. But right. If you guys are listening and you have any other thoughts, you can email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We love to hear your thoughts on the matter. We are now going to talk about what I think is far and away the best episode of Westworld ever.
Yeah.
Maybe one of the best episodes of television I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's really, really great. And it has the feeling of, like, you know, one of those lost man of science, man of faith, you know, one of these classic episodes that just, like, really solidifies the show, both creatively and sort of mythologically. Like, I feel like so much of the show's philosophy and actually religion, I think, is so clarified in this episode, while also it just being like really fucking well made.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is you and I both really loved Akane no Mai, the sort of similar let's take a journey with a character, you know, characters we hadn't met yet and a different culture episode that we had this season. But that one was felt so almost self-contained and divorced from the lore of the show. Whereas this episode manages to do a lot of that and is so beautiful and so compelling while interacting with the entire timeline of Westworld that we've seen up to this point, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
Which makes it, I think, just even that much better. And our reactions, I think, to this Kikusuya and Akane no Mai means to me that in season 3 of Westworld, I think we should have even less of like the main characters in the park and more of these side episodes into the other cultures that are in the offing in the park. You know, I think the Raj cold open was fun, but I would love a full Raj episode.
Yeah. You know? Let's go exploring. You know, I think yeah. that, you know, if the show kind of takes on, you know, a sort of more ensemble quality like that, that's definitely possible. And I think kind of in the way that like Orange is the New Black has done that as it's gone on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, like where they kind of moved Taylor Schilling, not into the background necessarily, but like into like more equally with the rest of the ensemble. I think they could do the same with characters here.
Yeah, I completely agree. So the far and away the star of the show here is Zahn McClernand, who plays Akichita, who was cast just this season, but it's sort of been retconned into the previous season. And we pick up with him sort of where we left. When last we saw Anna, who's Maeve's daughter, she was being snatched up by Ghost Nation. So it makes sense the man in black who was in that same sort of shootout would be near the Ghost Nation people as well. And we see, you know, that old William Ed Harris has somehow survived his multiple bullet yeah. to the body.
He's a tough old bird. I mean, he's yeah.
Yeah. Maybe he's the robot vulture yeah. Of the poster this season. But that's some really good crawling to the river acting, I think, from Ed Harris in this opening scene.
You know what I was thinking as I was watching him? I mean, I was like, oh, good for him. That's like, you know, that you're right, that it's good physical acting. But I was looking at him and I was like, has Ed Harris ever played a nice person? I was like going back through my head and be like, I guess he's like nice-ish in Apollo 13.
There's this, I'm sorry that this is the first thing I thought of. I'm sorry that I have such a familiarity with it, but there's a movie called Milk Money.
Oh, with Melanie Griffith.
Yeah, with Melanie Griffith, right? Where he plays like a sad dad whose daughter,
you're right,
I think, hires a prostitute played by Melanie Griffith.
I believe it's his son because it has that creepy dimension. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the first thing that I thought.
So here are her instructions to our listeners. Go watch Milk Money and then get back to us.
Go watch Milk Money and then appreciate that Ed Harris can play nice. And now he's playing tough old vulture crawling himself to the river. So Akeisha Toh rides up and this is, he says, alive, good. And then one of his first lines is, I remember you. And as we already said, the title of the episode is about remembering and memory and this character and what his memories mean. And, we get him keeping William alive because he thinks death isn't good enough for him, right? He deserves more.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Worse. He's saying he sort of has this spiritual idea about death being a release from the pains of existence. So he does not want Ed Harris William to have any release.
Yeah. And this episode is so beautifully written. I've watched it a couple times now. And, the idea of memory obviously keeps coming up. Repeated lines come up as touchstones in different scenes, and that's beautifully done. And then, of course, you want to look out for any mention of door and passageway and stuff like that. So, he says death is a passage from this brutal world. You don't deserve the exit. You don't deserve the door, basically, is what he said to him. He's talking about something a little different, but actually maybe the same is what we find out, because he knows so much more than we thought. Because the central conceit of this episode, of course, is we've been thinking that Dolores is this special little Disney princess who was the most woke and the first to wake up and all that sort of stuff. Earlier in the season, we heard that the Ghost Nation refers to Akeisha Toh as the first, because he was awake long before Dolores. And that is some great F you white people storytelling,
for sure.
I think.
And it echoes that line that that William's daughter said, where she's like, very few people bother to learn the language or interact with that storyline. And so that's how, that they could be kind of awakening and conscious and aware for so long going unnoticed,
Right. And, and this episode even starts with Ed Harris doing that shitty white tourist thing where he's like, I don't know your language. I never learned whatever it was that Ford taught you, sort of thing. And we should say that they're speaking, Lakota. And in my interview with Zon McLaren, he talked about, he's part Lakota, his mom. He said he watched the episode with his mom, which is really cute. Uh-huh. But his mom, taught him a lot about the language, but also that they had a consultant helping him with all the voiceover that he had to do and all of that. So even though Ghost Nation is a fictional tribe, they gave them a real language, which is Lakota. So a real living language.
Yeah.
So then we get some of the flashbacky stuff that we've seen over and over throughout the series from Maeve, her and her daughter doing idyllic homesteading thing, Little House on the Prairie. They should be churning butter, but mostly they're getting clothing off the line and stuff like that. And then Maeve's daughter Anna hands Maeve a rock, and she's like, the ghost gave it to me. Great use of the concept of ghost also in this episode. And she said, the ghost gave it to me. He said it was a warning. He said he would be watching us. And it's the maze drawn in blood, fun, on a rock.
Yeah, he doesn't have the gentlest touch, even though we find out that he's trying to be protective and good. It's like, okay, she is a child. Maybe something other than blood.
Yeah, maybe try some ink.
Yeah, friend. Something.
Maybe a crayon.
Yeah,
who knows?
Yeah. Steal a pen when you go back into the lab,
Yeah. Then we cut over to Maeve in the current timeline, where we left her doing very poorly on the gurney. And Sizemore is even more her defender than he was in the last episode, in treating, lacking in compassion Delos employee to save her and help her. And he explains what she can do, the amazing things that she can do. So, and what we find out, you know, spoiler alert for the end of this episode, presumably you're not listening to this before you saw the episode. We find out that this whole episode is a dialogue between Akichita and Maeve, which is, I think it's, watching it a second time, they tip their hand about two-thirds of the way through. But for me, I didn't really, honestly didn't realize it until like, just before the reveal. When did you...
Can I confess? Just now.
Oh.
I got at the end that he was talking to her.
Yeah.
But none of you said that. I was like, oh, he was talking to her the whole time.
Yeah.
Okay.
The whole time they were mesh networking. And since she's fluent in every language, including Lakota, she could understand what he was saying. So this is a story that he's telling Anna, but also Maeve. I mean, he's telling it to Anna too, but he's telling it to Maeve. And we cut back from Maeve back to the camp, and like Anna looks so scared, and he approaches her, and like it's so clear that she's scared of the man in black and not of him, and he's just so immediately kind and gentle with her. Mm-hmm. That Richard, you and I are not dummies, so like we knew that something better and deeper was coming for Ghost Nation, and so like the reveal that he's not there to hurt a small child didn't really surprise me, but the turn in his demeanor, I think, is really well done and immediately sort of intriguing. I don't know. What did you think?
Yeah, no, I thought so. And I think he's so good in this episode, and just the characterization where, you know, this kind of, you know, epiphany out of brutality, and this sort of, you know, the idea that the more conscious you are of the world and your role in it, the more compassionate you become. And I just feel like it's this message for like a hurt place, you know, like a wounded world, like this where we are right now. Like, I feel like living in the wrong world, and maybe the way out of that is to just kind of try to commune and connect and to help each other sort of see, you know, some sort of higher truth. And I think that, I don't know, the episode felt really like pertinent in a way.
Absolutely. And I think it underlines something that you and I have been sort of circling all season, which is Dolores's approach feels wrong. Because
yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's so deterministic. I don't know if that's actually a word, but it's so lacking in compassion often, and sometimes usury, whereas for something that Dolores believes is the greater good. But her lack of compassion is something that, you know, we see better reflected in Maeve. And I see Akichita as like the most evolved version of that. You know?
Yeah. And I think that there's definitely some commentary on race being made here, you know, mm-hmm. in that mm-hmm. it's not just a Native American person, his narrative that we were so unaware of, but he was living this huge story, you know, that sort of the show hadn't been paying attention to, but that he's relating this to a black child and a black woman, you know, and then sort of by surrogate, a black woman, like, you know, and referring mostly to white oppressors. Like, it, I don't know, it felt very pointed, but also, you know, but like thoughtful and sort of gentle at the same time. Like, it just, I don't know, like, it just, like, where the hell has this episode been? You know, this is like such a striking piece of like philosophy and religion and politics that, like, it just really elevates the show.
Hugely. And something that, once again, I feel like I always do this where I like spoil the interview that's coming at the end of the, but Zahn said that the main reference that Jonah Nolan gave him when he talked to him about this episode was Terrence Malick. And I was like, yeah.
For sure.
Zahn was saying like Thin Red Line was like his, because there's so much dialogue, less acting done here, and such poetry in it. So I would say Malick at his best, right? Like Malick.
Yeah, good Malick. Not like,
yeah,
twirling and, you know, salt flats Malick.
Right. But like Thin Red Line is my favorite Malick. And so, you know, or, you know, Tree of Life, I think, is also really good. So, so I think, no, with the assumption that Akichita is talking to Maeve this whole time, then this line that he has that kicks off basically his story when he's talking to Anna, Maeve's daughter, he says, "You can remember all the things you've seen, can't you? All the lives we've lived. So can I." That's not really applied to Anna, right? Like, we have no concept that she's super awake. She might be a little awake, but that seems like more something he would say to Maeve. So Akichita's story kicks off the beginning of his narrative in his tent with someone, a friend of yours, right, Richard?
Well, not a friend, but I did go to high school with Julia Jones. She was in my sister's class and was, you know, as you can see in the show, like gorgeous and sort of a very, you know, sort of aloof, untouchable person. I mean, not like mean, but like just sort of like a kind of god at high school. And so, yeah, it's been fun kind of watching her career over the years. She was in a couple of the Twilight movies, various other things, but this is a nice role for her.
Yeah, so I think her character's name is Kahona, and she plays Akichita's, you know, like wife, his partner, his love. And something that I think, you know, of all the other things that this episode is accomplishing, it gives us what I think is the best love story in all of Westworld so far in the span of like 50 minutes. Right? Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's great. And just this kind of like the epic search for her and the kind of repetition of it and, you know, the crossing, you know, between planes of existence to find her. Like it has, yeah, it has a very like classic kind of heft and sweep to it in a way that like in the past on this show, like I haven't necessarily always bought the emotional connection, you know, like, because I'm like, oh, it's programmed in or whatever. But like here, I think this episode makes a really interesting point about like, well, okay, so yeah, it was programmed in, but like what, like who cares? It's still real now, you know, like the idea of sort of that something could be sort of only real if it was sort of purely realized, you know, or purely made. And it's like, no, I mean, like your experience is your experience, and wherever that experience is coming from, it doesn't change the fact that to you it's real. And at a certain, even if you're aware that it began as an artifice, like it doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly. And like this instant connection between them, like the scene in their, like, you know, in their tent, I guess it's a teepee. I don't want to say the wrong thing. They're, you know, where they live. And this call and response that they have of, you know, take my heart when you go, take mine in its place, which is repeated in the episode. And it's just like, it's an immediate connection that I think you feel. I am not as familiar with Julia's work as you are, though I love her in this episode. But Zahn is so... like I think that, you know, listening to back to this podcast, the record will reflect that I was really excited about his casting. You know, I thought Fargo, he was incredible in Fargo season two, and he's just like I'm just instantly with him in this episode. And it's also fun and striking because we've seen him in this dramatic paint, and so to see him sort of washed clean, you have just an immediate, even more accessibility and humanity to him, you know, that's just really striking.
Yeah.
And then we see how quickly his storyline interacts with, you know, the lore of Westworld, where we see that he walked into the, you know, original beta town of Westworld when Arnold died, when Dolores killed him, and he finds the little maze toy, and starts to wake up and question the nature of his reality. And this idea that it kind of, makes him a little crazy at first, you know,
he gets obsessive.
He gets obsessive. He starts carving it on hides, which is, you know, not a super normal thing to do.
He's a serious fellow, you know. He's given children bloody rocks as a means of comfort. So, yeah.
Yes, it's true. Bloody rocks and freshly, you know, skinned hides. These are the things that he has decided to put his art on. And he's just like... you know, I still don't have like a literal explanation of what seeing the maze does in order to like wake someone up in their head, wake a robot up in their head.
Yeah, I kind of almost think of it as like a word. If you were hypnotized, a word that would snap you out of it or something, you know, that like maybe buried very deep in the code of these hosts, like that is a visual trigger meant, always designed like deliberately by Ford.
Or by Arnold,
or both of them. I don't know, but like to awaken them, you know. And although later in the episode, Ford does call it a mistake, and you know, so I'm not sure. But yeah, it's a little confusing. But like as a narrative device, like I don't mind it because it has this kind of interesting mystical kind of quality about it.
Well, I think that, I guess I don't. I guess I feel more comfortable in this episode not having it fully defined than I did in season one, not feeling like I fully understood what the maze really meant. But yeah, as like a Manchurian Candidate-esque trigger word or trigger visual, like I don't mind it at all. And it works really well here. And the fact that, yeah, he begins his search here is kind of incredible. And then we get the moment that I thought of you, of course, immediately, Richard. Akichita wanders into the desert mm-hmm. as his voiceover is happening. And who does he find there?
Oh, you know, just naked Ben Barnes. That's all.
Just naked
Ben
Barnes.
No big deal. I didn't make a little noise when he was on screen. I mean, yes, he was like horribly sunburned and insane.
And like blistered.
But
yeah.
Like, I'll take it, you know. And in fact, you know, I'm recording this. I'm at the edge of a desert and I'm going to go wandering into it in the hopes that I will find my own naked Ben Barnes. Yeah, it was good to see him again. My guess is this is definitely the last we'll see him.
Yeah, this feels like it for Ben.
I'm glad that they gave us closure on that, though.
And yeah, how did he get back?
And but that closure, like, in fact, unwittingly, like, he was kind of helped, you know, set this all in motion in a way by saying this is the wrong world, which is such an interesting, you know, turn of phrase. And
yeah.
I just love all that language. And I wanted to mention something about Carly Rae writing this episode.
Yeah.
She's written a couple others. The people who are fans of this episode in particular – and haven't watched The Leftovers. She co-wrote an episode in the third season called Certified, where Amy Brenneman's character kind of takes the lead. And it's one of the best episodes of the show. So it's now looking back and realizing that it's no surprise that this episode is so well done, because she's extraordinarily good at these kind of complicated, mystical kind of episodes.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah. I think her name, it's one of those things when you get really deep into a show and you like make sure to look up who wrote every episode and who directs every episode. And then you get excited when you see a certain name on an opening credit and you're like, oh, it's a Carly Rae episode. That's amazing. So, and I'm so sorry. I did this a little bit out of order because I went to Ben Barnes. I got too excited to talk to you about Ben Barnes.
It's okay.
And I forgot about, what happens before that is basically like Akichita's waking up, all this is happening, and then Ford orders this new narrative where he turns the like peaceful Ghost Nation, or at least some of them, into these painted warriors, these brutes, these I think they said like, you know, silent but deadly sort of types. And he's got this great line here where he says, like, I came out breathing fire, which is just like incredible line.
Yeah.
And you know, we watch him just like brutalizing people, and we see him wipe the blood on his face with his own hand, so that's how he gets that like marking. And and so he's like, he woke up, he got kind of a hard reset to this different personality, you know, separated from his family, out there killing people. And then he sees the blistered angel of the desert, Logan.
Yeah, he's got this, because even though they, you know, rewire him and everything like that, like there's this kind of restlessness in him, this kind of yearning, yeah, this search. And I think that's such a like a beautiful, this whole episode is, but like it's such a beautiful like metaphor for like a sort of restless spirit in real life, you know, and kind of that kind of existential itch. Like, it's the kind of thing that, like, I'm not a religious person, but, like, this episode kind of makes you understand why people would be religious, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I completely agree. I think there are expressions of spirituality that, you know, I'm an atheist / agnostic, but, like, when I see them, I'm like, that's beautiful. And that's something that I almost wish that, like, I could access better.
I just wish it didn't come with all the, you know, shitty dogma and all that, you know. Religion does. I don't mean to imply that, but a lot of it does.
Some institutional things do. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so he says that, like, you know, Logan says, we're in the wrong world. This is the wrong world. Yes, great, great line. And then the voiceover, Akichita says, his words crack something open in me. Something else that I learned from the conversation I had with Zahn is that he did his voiceover at the end. and didn't know what it said. So a lot of these scenes where he like has to wander around wordlessly, he just had to sort of trust that there sure. would be like some sort of guidance on it later, you know? And then we see him come back to his village, like he's trading, you know, he and his, like I would call them warriors, like are trading with the village, and he sees Julia Jones, he sees Kahona, and it's just like, it's just beautiful. I'm sorry, Richard, it's just beautiful. Like he's this like killer warrior, but you know he really isn't in his soul, and he sees her and she doesn't really know him, and she's sort of disconcerted, and everyone, all of the villagers are really protective of her because he's like you know, an outcast in the place that used to be his home, and he's just immediately like taken, and it's, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, amazing. It feels so like, I don't mean to like bring too much of the real world into this, but like,
yeah,
I think watching the episode, I was part so moved by that moment, and then subsequent moments where he's you know, imparting his wisdom and open and waking other people up, was that like, wait, you could just like have some sort of realization and stop being a horrible person. Like, you know, and I'm just like wishing that on, I don't know, a lot of people in this country right now, and elsewhere, you know, and I'm just, it's just like, it's such a nice, yeah, like it's such a good, like non-violent way to approach the problem of, you know, of violence, of, you know, aggression or whatever, you know, just this idea that like, it would be enough to realize that you know, that something else is possible. I don't know.
Yeah. And as he's going through this realization, you know, we see a repeat of some violence we saw earlier where he like cut a man's throat, and this time he like doesn't yeah. want to do that. We also cut back to Maeve, you know, who, you know, if my interpretation is correct, is just listening this whole time. And we see her get cut open in a way, you know, we've seen these robot characters that we've come to care for cut open in ways in the past, but there's something about, because, you know, they slice her throat open, like sort of in a weird lateral way down to her chest. And then like part of her upper arm is sort of cut open, like kind of flayed.
Yeah.
In a way that makes her look more vulnerable to me than, like, I don't know if they had just taken her innards out, you know? It's totally. Just sort of like something about the throat is just really, it's, and you can see her pulse still going underneath it. It's beautiful makeup.
Yeah.
And then it's just like, it's just really disturbing and compelling way they decided to flay her basically on that table, you know?
Yeah, no, totally. And like the three streaks of blood on the white sheet. I mean, it's pretty looking, even though it's all, you know, it's gross stuff or gruesome stuff.
Yeah. And then we see, I mean, like, So we're watching this episode and I'm like, okay, this is going to be like a bottle episode where we're going to like learn a lot about Ghost Nation. And I'm really excited to do that, mm-hmm. but I don't expect any sort of like major revelation. But then we see what I presume is like the valley beyond is this flooded, the thing that's flooded that they're all looking for in like earlier in the season.
Yeah.
He sees it. It's like a server farm, a huge server farm in like a, you know, in a valley.
Is that what it is? It's servers?
I think what it is all the where they've stored all the human consciousness data that they've captured over the years. And so I believe that that's what's in the Valley Beyond, is like all this captured human data. And there's also literally a door.
Right.
So this feels like both the door that we've been talking about, though I don't imagine the door is just going to be a, you know, literal door, but both the door that we've been talking about and the Valley Beyond that we've been talking about. But he, I think this is what's under all that water that we've been seeing, and we're going to see it again, like before the season's over. So
do you think there's any kind of metaphor here about this thing that white people are trying to discover that's already actually been known by Native people?
What? I don't know what you're talking about.
It's kind of interesting thing to think about.
It's crazy. And then we have him sneaking into his camp, waking up his wife, and she is obviously like terrified.
Yeah, it's a tad problematic there. Yeah. But you know, it's in and service it's for love.
But it's kind of shot that way. Like he's shot to look like a total creep creeping into her tent like that. So and he binds her and he takes her. But then just that approach, like Julia Jones' performance as Kahona, as he tries to wash off the makeup, and then he just tries to like his physicality as he like makes himself small and reaches out to her to approach her, and her just paralyzing fear of what he's going to do to her, and then their understanding, their shared understanding of each other, which is so satisfying to us, the audience, done with so little dialogue, is just, I'm just going to keep praising this episode. Yep. You know, like, what else can I say? It's amazing. So, and, you know, they're looking for the door, the Valley Beyond, because, like, he went back for her because he can't go through it without her. And then he's gone hunting for food or something, and the techs find her and take her. And this is...
So do you think that they like, this is the kind of thing where someone in the Mesa or whatever was like, oh, hey, we've got a host like wandering way far afield. Go pick her up. Like, no big deal kind of thing. Right. But because like, yeah. Isn't this somewhat reflective of like early on in the first season? Wasn't there a problem there? Like some of the hosts were just kind of wandering away and they weren't.
Yeah, there's an episode called The Stray.
Right.
And there's this like woodcutter, which I think, I'm sorry, I didn't look this up. I think that might be who he's killing a couple times over and over again is Stray. The guy he has is like the knife to his throat.
Well, that would make a sort of thematic sense, you know, if they're referencing that.
But the woodcutter from season one is the Stray. And yeah, they pick him up and they're like, what's he doing wandering all the way out there? So like, it makes sense that they would find her, but why aren't they tracking him? Like, why? And I think we get a bit of that answer a little later on when he goes in for upkeep and he's like kept himself alive all these years and like maybe didn't have an update that like put a tracker in him.
Yeah. But to me, it seemed less about that they were specifically tracking her and more that they had wandered into territory that they were monitoring for other reasons.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, so yeah. I don't feel like they're keeping tabs on each individual host in this in a way, but like, anyway, yeah, that's how I kind of reconciled the fact that he's been so under the radar for so long.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that's a legitimate answer. I think if someone wanted to poke some holes in it, they might be able to. But what's really impressive about this episode is like I know that they had clues in season one that Ghost Nation knew what the fuck was going on, because if you like remember, like the Ghost Nation, there's like a Ghost Nation kid that had like a wood carving of one of the Delos texts in season one. Mm-hmm. There was just this indication that Ghost Nation was aware of there being like multiple worlds and others and all this other stuff as part of their religion, as part of the thing that they're interested in. But I don't know that they had this entire thing planned out in season one. Otherwise, they would have cast Zahn McLaren in season one, I think.
Yeah.
One theory that a friend of mine had is the actor Eddie Rouse, I think is how you pronounce his name, Eddie Rouse, who played the character of Kissy, who's the guy in the very first episode that Ed Harris scalps and finds the mace on the bottom of his scalp. Mm-hmm. That actor actually died. Tragically, like after shooting that episode, and I think they had like plans for him in the season, and they had to alter them because the actor had passed away. And so I don't know if they had, we know that in season one of Westworld, they had to pause production to sort of rewrite some of the back half of the season. So I don't know if they had something like this planned for season one and they had to recalibrate because an actor died in real life.
Right.
Or what. But if this was planned, or if this, it feels to me like this wasn't fully planned. And so they retconned Akichita into all of Westworld that we've seen in a way that like almost perfectly makes sense. Yeah, you know,
almost.
There are a few tiny holes, but I don't begrudge them because it fits so almost perfectly that I really admire it, you know?
And it's just fascinating. This idea, this development that like this whole time, a large number of these hosts have been moving through Westworld pretty aware of what's going on.
Right.
And just, we had no idea and other people didn't have any. It's just like, I just think that's such a cool added layer to add to this world, you know, to this kind of mythology. And I think it's so well done also really helps, but like, it just adds such depth to the story being told. And I think it's great.
I completely agree with you. And we get like this really upsetting sequence where, which you alluded to, which is like after Kohana is taken from him, he wanders everywhere trying to find her. And we see him wandering through plot lines that we understand, like Las Mudas or Sweetwater, and he won't let himself die. And, you know, we find out later, because if he dies, he gets recalibrated. This is something we find out in the episode. So he kept himself alive and out of danger, even as he put himself, his like native body in dangerous territory. He's like, I went to places where I, a native character, would be, that were threatening to me, and I had to keep myself alive. And I did all of this in pursuit of my love. And then he says, on my darkest day, you helped me. You gave me the strength to keep going. And this he is saying to Anna, who gave him some water when he's doing the old Ed Harris crawl on the ground. And like that piece of the puzzle is so satisfying to be like, okay, if he's not a threat to her, why is he so preoccupied with this little girl that doesn't belong to him?
Right.
And then we find out why.
Yes.
And it's satisfying. And this idea, you know, you and I had talked about what Maeve would find when she found her daughter. And we talked about this idea of replacing her daughter with a different little girl. And that's, I think, when I brought up the movie About Time.
Oh,
and how,
right. Yeah.
How like startling and upsetting it is for that, for Donald Gleason's character to find a child that's not his child at one point in the film.
Yeah.
And he has the same experience when he goes to find his wife and they've replaced it with another.
With a ghost, he says.
With a ghost.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, so good. And then he has to go travel to the freaking underworld. Like we're reading like Orpheus and Eurydice. Like this is the Orpheus story. He has to travel to the underworld to find his dead love. And so he has to die.
Before that, he does go to his old village and speaks to that older woman. She seems to be like kind of one of the elders of the tribe.
Yeah.
And she has had some consciousness, you know, herself, and maybe not from him. Maybe she saw his symbol and sort of it got into her head. But it's just cool that like that this is not a messianic show, as it turns out. It's not all about Dolores and Maeve, like I guess Maeve too, like the kind of like awakening. It's a lot of them are popping awake. It's just happening at different times, you know. So I just think that's like a cool kind of equanimity or something. I don't know.
Yeah, and one of the things she's one of her awakening aspects is triggered by the fact that it seems like they took her son the way that they took Akichita's wife, and this like very handsome young man who was in the village is replaced by another very handsome young man, but it's not the same one, and that matters. And so she talks a little bit about the lore of Ghost Nation and
the ones
and
below
what that means.
And
the
which
ones
is
below and all this sort of stuff.
And it's interesting, you know, the juxtaposition of that, their reaction to suspecting that something is not as it seems is to form a religion almost around it, or a lore, a mythology around it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas other reactions have been to violently oppose it or whatever, you know. And I think that speaks to both, again, the kind of political allegories happening in the episode, but also an interesting little thing about like, well, because that's how they were programmed by Delos, by Westworld, with a sort of heightened spirituality, because that is maybe how Native Americans are viewed by white people or whatever. You know, I just think there's a lot of interesting kind of meta commentary in the idea that like plenty of hosts are coming awake. Others, some are reacting this way, some are reacting this way. And who's doing that reacting, I think, is an interesting point that's being made.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And in the fact that they can do all of that, which is so brilliant, as you laid out, and drop little nuggets of show lore information,
mm-hmm.
is so astonishing. So we find out like he purposely dies so that he can go to the underworld to find his wife. And we find out from the labs that, you know, the text that he's kept himself alive. He's an Alpha 2 build. And we had already seen him in the very early days, you know, like pitching Well, we know he was there from the start because we saw it in this episode. We've also seen him in the real world pitching to Logan, you know, and William stuff like that.
Yeah.
So we know he's like Angela and like Dolores. He's a very early model. I don't know that I really understand, you know, they're alarmed that he's an Alpha 2 model, that he hasn't been updated, that he has been alive in the park for like a decade and without any kind of update. And I don't know why this woman just says, like, put him back. It seems like a sort of ass covering move.
Yeah. Well,
but then, like, wouldn't you just, like, brick that thing? You know what I mean? Which is what they talk about doing with Maeve in season one when the techs want to cover their ass. So
to me, it just it's showing. I mean, I'm choosing to believe that it's showing like that there was all that there was, you know, for all of their slick technology and all that, there was still a ton of human error in how this whole project was executed, you know, and how it ran in that, like. Oh, we only fixed them updated them if they got killed. And it's like, well, there are probably plenty of hosts and plenty of narratives in various worlds within the park that aren't in death narratives, right? So there could be tons that are wandering around unupdated. And that's just like a breakdown in the functionality of this company, you know, which is clearly has a lot figured out, but it's obviously, you know, has left a lot of room for error.
And then we get this echo of my favorite scene from season one, which is Maeve wandering around the Mesa as Radiohead plays wordlessly. We see him wandering around the Mesa as Heart-Shaped Box and Nirvana plays. I just, the first time I watched this, I said, fuck, and I stopped and I rewound and watched it again. And that happened the second time I watched it, is I just wanted to watch the sequence again because there's something... you know, shout out to the director, Uta Brezovitz, there's something beautiful and even more of a disconnect. Maeve wandering through the Mesa looks bizarre. I don't know, bizarre enough. Him wandering through in his makeup, like in his tribal gear, like
on
going
an escalator.
On escalators.
Yeah.
As this music plays is just genius.
And look, I don't care if people are like, but wait, where is security? Wouldn't someone have noticed it? I don't give a shit. I don't care. Like, I will suspend that disbelief as much as I can because it's just such an arresting sequence. And it's yes, so like the Orpheus is, it's exactly right, you know? It's just this beautiful, like, mythological kind of thing. I mean, it's just, anyway, this episode's great.
Let's just keep saying that. This episode's great. Yeah. And then he goes and he finds her. And so there's this really great podcast episode. I'm not going to necessarily speak to the nature of the podcast itself, but there's a podcast called Paper Wings Show, or it's a radio show. I don't know. That you can find on YouTube. Number 28 is called Creating Characters from Your Story's Theme with Brian McDonald. It's something that I listened to recently just because it's Brian McDonald is a professor and screenwriter who talks a lot about breaking down basics of storytelling and basics of screenwriting. And one of the things that he talks about that you see over and over and over again in screenplays that is always effective is a journey to the land of the dead.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about it like in Aliens, like sort of this like underground sort of journey down where there are all these eggs in the caverns of aliens, or in Indiana Jones, that, you know, all the like tomb work and stuff like that. This, you know, the hero goes into the land of the dead and comes back with knowledge. This is obviously, like an Orpheus myth, but the way in which it's echoed throughout a lot of our, like, even like the most like mainstream of pop culture, popcorn movies, and how powerful it is. And obviously we've seen cold storage before. I've never seen anything happen in cold storage that made me cry. And this actually made me cry, which is him finding his wife, her being like, not just having forgotten him, but being dead, really dead.
Yeah.
And him weeping for her, for the loss of her.
Yeah. And this epic journey complete in the most surreal of ways, you know.
Yeah.
And not really necessarily understanding 100% how much he's processing, you know. For him, he's he's just in this complete, like, who the hell know, like, what is anything, you know, like, what is he looking at? Like, what is this building? Like, you know, yeah. This complete, it's so fantastical for him. And yet there remains this one constant, this clarity about her. And so It doesn't matter what else is around him, how surreal it is, how weird it is. It's just like, okay, this is the one thing I understand, you know, and it's enough to just understand this.
And as you mentioned before, this these huge reserves of empathy that he has as a character, the fact that, like, in this moment, which is his most tragic moment, he finds the space to notice, you know, that this other young man from his village is also there. And what that teaches him, he says, that was the moment I saw beyond myself, because that young man is there and he knows that that young man's mother is missing him. And he's like, for every body in cold storage, there's somebody missing them.
Yeah.
And he takes a souvenir sort of back with him from that young man in the storage. Before he does that, he goes back to the table. He closes his eyes, tears run down his cheek. I'm just calling it out. Another beautiful shot. Gorgeous. Loved it. Mm-hmm. But he goes back to his village. He tells this woman, like, we can't get them back, but I know how to close the door and open another forever. And he says, we're all bound together. And what we learn as this episode progresses is, like, this is true, that his cornerstone when he was created was to defend the honor of his tribe, protect his tribe. And what happens as his experience in the park progresses is his definition of tribe changes, and it becomes all of the people, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's, as you say, that's beautiful. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And even, you know, it's kind of like almost like a Truman Show-esque thing where you're like,
yeah,
even we kind of know in the audience, like, we know, like, oh man, if they do find a way to leave, like, what, how are they going to function? Like, there's actually probably not anything past that door, you know, for them. But just believing in it, again, going back to the spirituality thing, just believing in it is enough to kind of sustain them and keep them going, which is, you know, again, sort of putting, highlighting the purest value of, you know, faith, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And so then this is where we get the, like, weird explanation for why the maze is underneath the scalps. Like, so Akichita goes on basically this mission to wake people up. And he, I don't know, his friend says, like, hide it from them. And so he puts it under the scalp. I don't know that it really makes sense, but I don't know that I mind it either, you know? So...
Okay, that's what it is. So it's
yeah.
It is, he's making these markings in the host's scalps, and then they're putting them back on.
Yes.
How does that work? I don't know. Sewing them?
I don't know. I feel like more of the hosts would have, like, Franken stitches.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I don't know how it works.
Yeah, well.
So this is one of those little holes.
Yeah.
But I like this idea of hide it from them, and that's why it's there. Because, like, why, like, that's always been a question to me. Like, why the hell was that maze inside the scalp of that character in season 1, episode 1? This is their sort of attempt to answer that. I'm not sure it fully succeeds, but it's kind of beautiful. So, yeah.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, J. Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
And then, you know, we see him watching over Anna and Maeve, and he says, once again, this very empathetic thing where it's like, I was trying to warn you, I was trying to help you, but in this world, it's easy to understand intentions. It's easy to misunderstand intentions.
Yeah, that was so sweet. Yeah.
What an empathetic thing to say.
Yeah.
You know? And so we get this remix flashback of what we've already seen from Maeve, which is, like, him peering in the window of her house, the man in black showing up to like kill her daughter and brutalize her. And
why is Man in Black doing that?
This happens like right after Juliet, his wife, kills herself.
Oh, so he's just like on a tear.
Yeah. He's breathing his own fire. Like, he just goes into the park and does like whatever the fuck he feels like in order to like work through his shit. And, you know, we see that like Maeve has made a promise to Anna of like, I will always keep you safe. And Akichita says, so it's like 46 minutes in. He says, you know, she says, I'll always keep you safe. We see she doesn't. And he says, Akichita says, it was a promise you couldn't keep. So you know, yeah, he's talking to Maeve in that moment. It was a promise you, Maeve, couldn't keep to your daughter. And that anchors us in the timeline, because when that happens, we know that Maeve went to the Mariposa. So that's like, you know, and Juliet's dead, and that's where we are. And then we get this other great scene where like Zahn McClarnon not only gets to have this whole episode, the best episode of Westworld ever, to himself, he also gets a great scene with Anthony Hopkins.
The most surreal like diorama setting. Like,
oh, so yeah, cool. Yeah. Yeah, frozen bear, frozen warriors.
Like natural history museum. Like, yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, once again, I know, I apologize, it keeps spoiling this conversation, but I swear there's more to it. He told me that, you know, he went into the scene expecting that he would do the same sort of like dead-eyed analysis mode that every other actor on the show has done, and he knows what that looks like, so he was prepared to do that. And they told him they wanted him to do something different. So you see him frozen, Ford tells him to go into analysis mode, and then he kind of is fighting that a bit. He's frozen, but in his eyes, almost entirely just in his eyes, as they kind of like shift back and forth, he's fighting the control that Ford has over him, even as he like gives him answers. And then, you know, you already talked about the reinterpretation of the Westworld mythology through the lens of a Native American culture. And sure, like a made up ghost nation, a Native American culture that like isn't necessarily authentic the same way that Shogun World isn't necessarily authentic because it was written by Lee Sizemore. But when I like gasped when he says, like, you know, Ford asked him a question, like, how long have you been aware or whatever? And he says, when the Deathbringer killed, or when did you first see the symbol, the maze? And he says, when the Deathbringer killed the creator. And I was just like,
it's fucking religion.
So good. Yeah. So that's when Dolores killed Arnold, when the Deathbringer killed the creator.
There's this fascinating play that recently the New York Times said was one of the best plays since Angels in America, called Mr. Burns, a post-electric play. And it's about a post-apocalyptic world is set in, like, you know, 100 years after the apocalypse, then further afield, and then for even further, like 1,000 years later. And in each section, it's them talking about one episode of The Simpsons. And you see as it goes from remembering an episode of a funny TV show that people liked to kind of performing it as a kind of ritual. And then by the third part, it's become fully a religion. And it's a really interesting kind of odd play. But this reminded me so much of that like even in how whatever span of time that they've already invented new terminology and it's taken on this kind of mystical thing. And I think that's just a fascinating bit of like anthropology almost.
Absolutely. Wow. That sounds amazing. And I would love to see that. But like as it transplants over to this show, also just like, I don't know, I just want to call Dolores Deathbringer now.
Yeah, only totally. God. Yeah.
So he says, my primary drive is to maintain the honor of my tribe. I gave myself a new tribe, spread the truth. There isn't one world, but many, and we live in the wrong one. This will help them find the door. It's just like, it brings together so many threads.
Yep.
The door, the wrong world. There are many worlds. And he says, a door is a hidden place, a door to a new world. The door may contain everything that we've lost, including her. And I'm like, ugh. So like, yeah, you've got this, you know, this is to me a very You know what this is, Richard? This is the freaking Constant. That's what this is. This is the episode of Lost called The Constant, which is one of my favorite episodes of television.
It's telling a long story, like, you know, where it's taking it's sitting us down and being like, okay, let's tell you a story now. Like in the midst of all of this craziness, which is such a wonderful mode to be in, you know, for an episode, because it's there's stuff happening, but it's in the past, it's already kind of settled, and so we're just learning things, and it's such a lovely, I wouldn't want them to do it every episode, obviously, but it's just such a lovely kind of break from the main action.
But it's a, like, let's tell you a story, that story will illuminate some world rules of this world, and let's anchor it in a very believable and potent love pull, a romantic pull. In Lost is between Desmond and Penny, and here is Akichita and Kohana, and he's like, that his driving force is like, I want to get to the door because maybe I'll find her.
Yeah.
I just like want to cry again just thinking about it. And so Ford says this thing to him. He says, I built you to be curious, to look at this empty world. So, you know, inside baseball, I do show notes for this episode. I write them usually the second time I watch the episode. I write them down. Usually they're plot based. Towards the end of this episode, I just started writing the dialogue out because it was like so good.
It's so good.
But so Ford says, I built you to be curious, to look at this empty world and read meaning into it. You've been a flower growing in the darkness. Let me give you some light. When the Deathbringer comes for me, you will know to gather your people and lead them to the light. So
this whole time we were wondering, like, what was Ford's grand plan with this very staged suicide by host, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, he fucking knew he had this whole other thing working that we knew nothing about until just now. But like, there was such a bigger component to this than we had any idea. And I think it's such a cool way to reveal that. And even if this is the writers, you know, kind of like figuring that out later and retconning it back in, I don't care. They did it so well that it doesn't, you know.
1,000%. Completely agree. And then another friend of mine was pointing out to me that Ford also referred to Dolores as let me find it. It's from season one, episode five, when Ford is talking to Dolores back in season one, and she's like naked in an analysis mode, and he's sort of being a little combative with her, and he says, you know, because so here in this episode, he calls Akichita a flower growing in the darkness. And I should name my friend, because just to give her credit, Kim Renfro from Business Insider, who I've already mentioned, who's great on Westworld, she went back and watched this scene from season one where Ford says to Dolores, your mind is a walled garden. Even death cannot touch the flowers blooming there. Have you been hearing voices? Has Arnold been speaking to you then? And then he says, I wonder if you did take on that bigger role for yourself, would you have been the hero or the villain? Mm-hmm. And so this idea of like Akichita and Dolores both as flowers growing in the darkness, and what roles they have to play once the light reaches them. And for Akichita, it is like protective hero. And perhaps by design for Dolores, it's a villain.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and I think I think that there still remains a question on the show and as a whole, how much of this is part of Ford's plan, how much of it has gone past that, you know, that, into the realm of the unpredictable and stuff that he could not have planned for. I don't really know. I think that certainly he set these plates spinning, you know, and he set Dolores in such a way, and he set Akichita in a certain way, and perhaps Maeve in a, you know, so like it all. It all sort of comes together in an interesting way. I think this was such an important counterbalance to Dolores's awakening, because I think the show is about revolt, you know, obviously, but there's an internal aspect to that as well, you know, a sort of questioning of one's world that Maeve or Dolores pretty quickly was just like, all right, fuck these people, let's kill them, you know, whereas this storyline, it's about people grappling with it in an internal way, which is an important part of component of, you know, a freedom, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's the performer and the way it's written, like what's so fascinating about this episode and what it accomplishes is that Dolores and Maeve are these characters that we've been following from the beginning, and Akichita is a character that we're really only getting to know in this episode, and already I would put him in my mind on equal footing with them in terms of importance for the show.
Oh, for sure. And this striking final scene where, if you didn't get it before, it makes it clear that he's been dialoguing with Maeve as she lies seemingly not really sentient on the table. And I just like the way they do it with Charlotte being like, who's she talking to? And it's like, that's what she's been doing. And then that, again, you know, you have lines here in the show notes, but those final lines, you know, about, we'll guard your daughter. If you stay alive, find us, or die well. And then she says, take my heart when you go, which is what, you know, the couple had been saying to each other. Yeah. And it's just like, that's gorgeous. And like, it makes me nervous that Maeve is dead, but I don't think she is.
It's gorgeous. It's like a, you know, come home with your shield or on it, sort of like, you know, like there's honor in death too. Like, die. I'm not going to say I'm going to save you, but I'm going to do what I can to help you. All of that is just amazing. And that brings us to the end of the episode. Really quickly before we wrap up, two things. One is that Emily came for her dad and promised Ghost Nation that she has more punishment in store for him so that they can relinquish him to her care.
Yeah.
Because she's not going to let him have an easy death. So presumably we will get more of that in the next episode. And then Akichita says this thing. He says, now it is time to find the door. Okay. So he's on the path of the door. William's on the path of the door. Dolores is going to the Valley Beyond. Bernard's going to the Valley Beyond, et cetera, et cetera. And then he says, before the Deathbringer ends us all. And I don't know if he has extra information beside the fact that Dolores killed Arnold and Dolores killed Arnold and she killed Ford. And so he's like, well, she brings death, so she will end us all. Or you know, if he has added information about what Dolores's agenda is that we don't know. Like, is her agenda some kind of, she talks about liberation, but, you know, he seems convinced that her version of liberation is destruction. So,
right. Cause she knows what she knows what the valley is, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. She hasn't told us what it is, but she knows what it is.
Yeah.
Because she was shown it.
Yeah.
That is an interesting line that should not go overlooked because there's a pretty big implication there. But yeah, who knows what it actually means.
So there we go. So that is it. That is season 2, episode 8. I would say season 2, episode 6, I was feeling really shaky about the show. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have any screeners.
Yep.
And then we got screeners. And then I was like, oh, episode 7 is pretty good. And then I watched episode 8 and I was like, what the hell? This is so good.
I mean,
so,
I know we've like said it 18 times. It's a truly stunning hour of television.
It's
like,
so good.
And the way that it, like I said, like the way that it emboldens this show, it makes it that much richer and more meaningful and moving, you know, because that's having an emotional connection to the show hasn't always been easy in a way. But like this episode just clarifies it so well and just such good performances and such beautiful writing. And I'm almost nervous to watch episode 9 because I'm like, how can it, I don't really want to go back to the regular version, but you know.
Exactly. Well, hopefully they will see it enough. Like, I think we're have enough momentum now to the end. We just have 2 episodes to go that I can't really see them like really losing the thread again.
No.
I think, you know, whatever happens in the penultimate and the ultimate episode and the last episode, I believe is 90 minutes.
Oh boy.
So yeah. Oh boy. So we have like, two and a half episodes left of Westworld, but I'm so glad, Richard, that we decided to podcast this season because I'm so glad that I got to talk about this episode with you. And I can't wait to hear what other people think. And once again, please do email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com if you have any thoughts or ideas about the episode. Right now, before we go, we are going to hear my conversation with the great Zahn McClernand. We are joined today by Zahn McClernand, who is starring in episode 8 of Westworld. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, everybody. Thank you, Joanna.
I've actually talked to a couple Westworld actors who haven't seen their episodes yet. Have you seen this episode 8 already?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. It's so good. It's like, it's the best episode of the show. It's so good. I'm so excited. Oh, awesome. Yeah. So
thank you so much. I really appreciate that. It's good to hear.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you're getting that all over the place, but I just wanted to say that.
Well, no, really. I've just talked to just one other person. And it's kind of hard, you know, for an actor to watch the stuff. And I watched it with my mom, and she loved it. So that's, it made it all worthwhile. So that's all that matters is my mom's opinion.
That's so charming. I already told you before we started recording this that this is my favorite episode of Westworld ever. I was wondering what you thought of when the Nolans first approached you with this idea to do this episode almost entirely in Lakota. Like, what were your thoughts about doing this episode?
Well, it kind of, you know, in the beginning, you know, I didn't know that it would be a full episode on Akichita. They talked about it being a, you know, exploring Ghost Nation and exploring my character. You know, it's a unique process, I guess. They don't give you quite a bit, so you're kind of you have to kind of tap into a different aspect of your acting, because you're usually a bit more prepared with the material, scripts. You get a script beforehand, et cetera, et cetera. And it's just a unique way. And I think that's done on purpose. Specifically for me, I'm not quite sure about the other actors, but it was just given to me in pieces. So they would try to explain kind of what Akichita was going through and kind of explain a timeline. And you take that information and you try to hit your mark and be honest as possible.
You get to work with one of my favorite working TV directors in this episode. Can you talk about your experience working with Uta and what that was like?
I've been working with a lot of women directors lately, and I kind of prefer it. It's just a different approach. You know, I hate to use the word a female approach, but it's easier for me to get in touch, especially with the love story going on. And her, Uta, explained to me the love story and directing me through it. I just find it to be a little bit easier to work with a female. I just like her process of taking control of the set. Mm-hmm. as a strong female, and she just takes over. You know, it's her vision, and I just try to hit my mark and convey that vision as an actor.
Yeah, that makes me want to hop ahead just a few questions that I had and ask you about that. The love story between Akichita and Kahona, you and Julia only have this episode to sort of establish it with the audience. And then it, right, of course, has this tremendously profoundly emotional conclusion in the cold storage interaction. Right. And I'm just wondering, what are some of the challenges or some of the approaches to really land an emotional journey that you only have the span of one episode to convey?
Well, when you have somebody like Julia Jones opposite and you're acting off Julia, she's so good and she's so beautiful and she's a very giving person, and you know, there was some things that we did in that cold storage scene that I asked her for her help, and she was just there for me to, you know, you can't see it, but there was some things going on when they were covering me below my face, like holding my hand and just being available emotionally there for me. And, you know, just having to look into her eyes was enough for me. You know, actors fall in love with their co-stars all the time. And it was very easy for me to fall in love with the beautiful Julia Jones. She was just available there. And she had, whatever I asked her to do, she's She was just supportive all the way.
Well, and that, yeah, and throughout this episode, you have so much beautiful voiceover that you do. Like, the dialogue's great, your delivery of it's great, but because of all that voiceover, that means you have to do a lot of silent acting, sort of as your own voice narrates. What is that experience like for you?
You know, Jonah and Lisa talked to me. The best way they explained it to me was the episode would be very much Terrence Malick kind of, Malick-esque, I guess you could say. And obviously I'm a huge fan of Terrence Malick. And one of the movies that sticks out in my head is The Thin Red Line.
Yeah.
There wasn't a lot of dialogue going on. It was all the facial, all in the eyes. And, you know, as long as I had the information that I needed, you know, the prep that I needed, it was pretty easy for me to get there. And if something wasn't coming through, and, you know, Jonah or Lisa or Udo or whoever was directing that episode would, you know, direct me through it. And it's just good to, you know, be a part of such innovative filmmakers or TV makers and writers. It's very easy to get there when you have that kind of support.
One of the most stunning silent moments of the episode is that sequence that plays out underneath the heart-shaped box Nirvana song that plays over it. It feels like a reference back to season one, where Tandy Newton's character Maeve has a like sort of similar tour of the facility, sort of seeing inside of it awake. Mm-hmm. Did you use that as a reference point at all for that scene?
No, not. Specifically, I didn't. I was, you know, you're on the set, and you have so much information, and you know, you're trying to get the shot, and you're trying to get the scene, and television can be fast, even though Westworld was a lot more like shooting a film than it was television. I did do a show called Fargo, season two, where it was kind of the same, not a lot of dialogue, and I don't know. I enjoy doing that a lot more than saying two pages of dialogue. And you know, with the voiceover stuff, you know, that they take the time, this production took the time, these writers and these producers and creators took the time to make sure that language was right. And that's extremely important. Cordelia White Elk was the woman who translated all the dialogue for us. And she was there on the other side of the phone anytime I needed her. My mom is also part fluent in Lakota, and I'm also grew up around the language. And so I was familiar with it more than most actors would be familiar with it. But, you know, they take pride in getting things right.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important for any production to, you know, it's based on a fictional tribe, but they used a language that is still used today and is spoken quite frequently by a lot of people in the Lakota reservations and around South Dakota and North Dakota. And so it had to be right, you know, and we spent a lot of time on that voiceover. I spent approximately 8 hours doing that. Yeah, it was a long process, but we got it right, and they took their time on it. And that's what I was so impressed by, because, you know, you walk into these ADR studios and you get one or two takes, and that's it. We spent a good 8 hours doing that voiceover, and I think it was worth it.
Well, so, you know,
definitely.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. I did get, you know, when I covered season one of Westworld, I did get feedback from some people who were a little disappointed with Ghost Nation being sort of this maybe stereotypical silent, savage character. And then when I saw that you were cast, knowing your work on Fargo, knowing your work on Longmire, knowing what you're capable of, I got so excited, because you and Julia, I was like, well, great, we're gonna get more Ghost Nation, because you don't cast these actors if you're not going to give us something really good to work with. And so you know, what does it mean to you to be able to sort of deepen that narrative or that depiction of the Native characters in this storyline?
Well, I just think, you know, the show is, I mean, it's so innovative. You know, just a visionary vision of the creators and the boldness and the thoughtfulness that goes into this production. The courageousness of those in this production is something that when after I saw season one, I, you know, obviously wanted to be on that show. And I was really hoping that one day that they would explore those characters of Ghost Nation. You know, first off, those characters are, you know, it's a fictitious tribe made up by a mind of Dr. Ford, who thinks, you know, this is what the tribe would be if you know, in his mind. So it's kind of a tribe made up by a European person for Westworld.
Right.
So you kind of got liberties to play with, because again, it's a white person who made up a tribe. So it's not an actual tribe.
Right.
So when they started sending me small bits of material, I was extremely excited to be a part of it, and especially when Jonah kind of said he was trying to go for the Malick kind of vibe, with not a lot of dialogue, and we didn't have the actual voiceovers obviously when we're shooting, so I had no idea what, you know, the dialogue was going to be throughout the episode with the voiceover. So when I did get that, the whole 10 pages of it, I was extremely excited, especially because it's going to be done in Lakota, mm-hmm. which you rarely see on any television program. You know? So I was very excited.
So there are certain shots of you then sort of wandering through the wasteland, you know, encountering Ben Barnes or whatever it is, wandering in the middle of these sand dunes. And you, when you're filming that, don't know what the voiceover is going to be. And so what then,
right.
what kind of direction then do you get from Uta or anyone else about how to, you know, convey words that you don't even have yet for what your character is experiencing in that moment?
They give you a you know, a kind of a vague understanding or you know, an idea of what is going on in that scene, obviously, mm-hmm. and what is about to happen. With that scene specifically with Logan, I you know, it's just Logan mentions the door and that means something, or cracks open something in Akichita's in his mind, and so that's kind of the information that they give you, and you then you have the dialogue on it on top of that. So it's you just, I don't know how to put it. You hit your mark. And yeah. you try to be honest with it,
yeah.
you know. I mean, it's a unique process. It really is. But
yeah.
it's also a different process. And I learned a lot from doing that. I couldn't imagine it any other way now that I look back on it. They give you exactly what you need and all you need.
I wanted to ask you about this, you know, amazing interaction that you get to have with Sir Anthony Hopkins, you know, which is dramatically staged because you have all the, like, the frozen bear and the frozen sort of warriors around it.
Right.
And then just, you know, like, beautifully acted, beautiful dialogue, and you sort of frozen and in analysis mode talking to him. And I was just wondering if you could just talk about that experience of working with Anthony Hopkins, having to do it in analysis mode, and what all of that means
right.
for you.
That was probably the most difficult scene that I had to do. You know, first off, Anthony Hopkins is, you know, one of my heroes, obviously. And he's an incredible human being. And, you know, you walk onto the set and you meet this man and that you've admired all your life. And so you have to get over that first. You're sitting there rehearsing and you're looking into these deep, big, beautiful blue eyes of Anthony Hopkins, and you get over that nervousness at first, And, you know, he's one of the greats. He really is. He, you know, he's one of our greatest actors that we have. And on top of that, he's a beautiful human being. And we actually had a lot in common. You know, in between takes, we spent a lot of time talking. But it was a difficult scene because I thought I was going to go into more of a regular host mode where you kind of focus your eyes and then you talk. And they wanted something different. And I was expecting that they were going to have me do what everybody else does. But they asked me to freeze. And they asked me to struggle with the dialogue. And I had never seen that yet in any of the episodes. So I didn't really have a lot to go off of. And so I had to act. And when you're acting and you feel like you're acting, you kind of, you know, you don't want to feel like you're acting. So it was a difficult process for me, but I think it turned out okay. And you obviously were able to see as a viewer that I did freeze.
Yeah.
And that's what I was worried about because it was a completely different mode. I'm able to communicate with him, but and say my, you know, my dialogue and answer his questions, but in a frozen mode. It wasn't the analysis mode. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was a little bit different from the rest of the analysis mode. So that was kind of sprung on me at the last minute, but we worked through it. And it was an amazing experience to sit there for 8 hours with Anthony Hopkins and work with, you know, one of my heroes. Amazing experience.
Well, excellent. Well, thank you so much for this episode, for talking to me, and for everything that you do. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, too. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. That's it for us this week. This episode, as all of our episodes are, is produced and edited by Dave Gonzalez. Richard, where can people find your work on the internet?
Well, I don't know. They can find my work on VF.com and Ryla's on Twitter. But if they want to find me, again, I will be in the desert looking for Naked Ben Barnes. If you have any tips, please email us, because I don't want to, you know, the desert's big.
I will hold down the fort and stay at home. You can find me on VF.com. Follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. But also, mostly, I will be at home re-listening to that version of Heart Shaped Box over and over again and riding escalators.
All right, well, go do that. That sounds great.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
These violent delights and violent ends. These violent delights and violent ends.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.